Senate State Affairs Committee will come to order. We have a quorum with Senator Huggins, Stoltz, and Senator Willickowski. The time is 9:02 Alaska Standard Time, adjusted daylight savings time. We have before us the sponsor of both bills we have before us. Welcome, Senator Faircliff. Or Senator McKinnon, I'm sorry.
Thank you for keeping the general public informed.
And joined by Senator McGuire as well. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee, for the record, Senator Anna McKinnon, representing Eagle River and the military bases. First before you is Senate Bill 6. It's requesting a conversation with the people of Alaska about the repeal of daylight saving time. As many of you know, in 1784, Benjamin Franklin, in an effort to save wax and wicks, suggested that we could change the time that we do our daily living activities and save energy.
And just briefly, Senator Coghill, the Vice Chair, has joined us. Our team is at full strength, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Daylight saving time was first implemented in the United States in 1918. And in 1966, America adopted the Uniform Time Act. In 2005, the Energy Policy Act extended daylight saving time, where now we're participating in the moving forward of 1 hour every day for almost 7 months. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't have any personal ambition about repealing daylight saving time or not, but what I would like to bring to your attention is some of the effects that daylight saving time has differently than other states on Alaskans and Americans in general. There are, on tab number 4 in your binder, we give you one study referring to health consequences, specifically for our male population. I know that each of you are aware of the heavy instances of suicide in Alaska. I alluded to this in a previous session when I first brought forward daylight saving time. I asserted that that there may be a relationship between suicide and daylight saving time, and it's just the flipping. It's the changing of times and how everyone's body associates itself with the sun. We are creatures of this world, and the sun and the moon actually does have an effect on our well-being. And as we move back and forth between these two times that are artificially put before us by the U.S. government, we are affecting people's health. And so in your packets, there are studies. We have studies that show that heart attack rates for men in the first 24, 48 hours coming out of daylight saving time in March, that your heart attack rates increased by almost 5%. So as well as we have a study now included in your packet under tab 4 that shows the rates of suicide for men. There's also on tab 5 issues regarding safety in the workplace and car crashes that happen more frequently in the spring. We've had feedback from across the state, but specifically in Northwest Alaska regarding attendance issues in schools, as well as testing issues for our students and how students actually have lower performance rates when we move on and off of daylight saving time. And while I haven't provided it, but I do have the documentation for you, we have studies regarding energy and the increased energy costs, at least in Indiana. When they moved on to daylight saving time, they saw an increase of $9 million overall for that increase. So what I'm here to tell you is that in the past, we've moved on and off because of energy issues with daylight saving time. And while that may or may not be a fact, from my perspective, we have adverse health effects with this flipping on and off. I always like to know who is in support and who is in opposition to different pieces of legislation so that we make sure that we bring those particular constituencies to the table when we talk about policy issues that could affect businesses or health. And so I would just advise you that some feedback I've received is from the financial markets. They're concerned that moving off of daylight saving time would create their employees having to come to work 1 hour earlier. So we would be off of Wall Street, per se, by 5 hours for almost 7 months out of the year. And so that is a concern that those employees would have to come to work earlier. But I would refer you to another tab in your binder of personal testimony, and you'll see that Mr. Dan Cuddy, President, CEO of First National, is in favor of moving the time zone. That's just one instance of people with different perspectives on this issue, but I wanted to make sure that you knew that from a financial perspective, people would have to come to work earlier, possibly to meet those markets or change the way that they do business in some way. To counteract that particular assertion, we do have people that believe that technology has brought us a long way and that those business practices could be accommodated in this world for Alaska. The second group that I had heard from when I carried this bill in the past was the networks. And the networks said that they may have trouble bringing live TV, a live football game, like I'm not sure how many of you watch the Seahawks play, but that live football may be a challenge because of timing issues. So to try to address that particular need, we extended the effective date out until 2017 so that those that had to schedule things like Alaska Airlines, who we're reaching out to, and others that have scheduling issues, cruise ships as an example, that they would have a full year and a half to implement changes and so they could respond. So we've tried to be responsive to people who have suggested troubles for their particular industry. In addition, I had a group of individuals before me yesterday during a meeting environment that was talking to me about daylight saving, and those are private tourism companies that have direct schedules that are tied to when a cruise ship docks. And the specific folks who spoke to me yesterday said there may be difficulty in having the last helicopter flight or the last air flight during an evening if we moved forward in time and stay there. So that's the opposition that I know of today. In favor of opposition, I believe, are over 50% of Alaskans. We have a survey that is opening up online right now. That's at alaskasenate.org/DST. Last year, we had over 500 people. I'm sorry, the last time I had this legislation up, we had over 500 people from across Alaska. Specifically, our teachers in Northwest Alaska, as I've said before, are supportive and talk to increased disruption in their classroom during that
time. I
believe
there was also a letter, I don't know if it did, distributor members from a Microsoft executive. The fact is we can count all the opposition on a hand. And I think Microsoft was concerned on behalf of the owner this might impair the ability of the Seahawks to
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this issue is very important to Alaskans. It's been over 6 years since I carried it. One of your committee members had a bill that's very similar. The difference between the bill I introduced 6 years ago and the bill that's introduced today is previously we had tied it to specific dates on daylight saving time. And as we moved through the process, what we found is that the federal government could change that anytime they wanted to, and Alaska would then randomly be forced back on it by a change if it extended it further or reduced it. And so we've tied it directly with the federal government's code on time versus the specific date. So that's how it's different, as well as the effective date is further out to accommodate those that may be adversely affected by scheduling.
Senator McKinney, can you also, back in 1983, I think you might not have been born yet, Senator McGuire. The committee here in Juneau, the committed to keeping the capital in Juneau, was a proponent of consolidating our time zones. Can you have some discussion on that? When I first worked in Juneau, we had a two-hour time difference.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's fair. Thank you. Another group that geographically that has been in opposition is Southeast Alaska. The conversation as we consolidated time zones was that Southeast had given up an hour. They used to be linked to Seattle, and they still believe that their economy is crucially linked to Seattle. And so they feel like they've already given up their hour by as a team effort for the whole state to align, so that government services, when we called Nome, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Tuktsuk Bay, Unalaska, that we would all be on the same time zone. There are two time zones, as I understand it now. I believe ADAC and further out is on Hawaii time, but my staff could give you more specifics on that. But certainly,
Senator McKinney, do you recall how many time zones there were in Alaska prior to the consolidation?
There were five.
Five time zones, almost more than the continental United States.
Mr. Chairman, I would add that our original attempt was to advance Alaska's time zone and stay off of daylight saving time, so we would be 3 hours off of the stock markets and aligned with Seattle. The problem with that is that at least we were told at our first request that we couldn't do that. And so we're following that back up because we've done additional research and found that other states are actually doing that. So this bill is specific about the revolving back and forth issue. And the back and forth issue is directly related to health, and we can show those statistics. But truly, we need to have an additional conversation at some point about whether the consolidation of five time zones was the right thing to do, because rural Alaska in the Arctic, in the Northwest Arctic most specifically, is 3 hours off of noontime. So just think about that for a second. If the sun is telling you it's noon and the clock is telling you it's 3 o'clock, students in the Arctic are playing until 9 or midnight at night because the sun is still keeping them up and running in Alaska. And so their whole body is sort of shifted in an artificial way. And I certainly don't want to speak for those in the Arctic. I'm just letting you know that the sun time that they experience is the most significant off for health reasons. And that's why, as I had served on Alaska's Suicide Prevention Council, why I hypothesized that could there be an issue with our sun time versus suicide rates. And I didn't have any proven studies when I carried this bill 6 years ago. We have some initial research on it now that says there may be research that points us that direction.
And I'm going to ask one or two more questions, and we'll turn to Senator McKinnon. You referred to we were told we couldn't do that. Who are the authorizing entities? Who do we have to ask permission to do this? What are the give us a better idea of where, irrespective of whether or not we, if we pass this law, what are the next steps?
We would issue a letter from the Department of Transportation to the federal government and make our case for changing a time zone. If I could ask my staff to join me, she might be able to provide additional information.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Schein, and I am staff to Senator McKinnon. Mr. Chairman, the process in which we would change a time zone to be on permanent daylight saving time would be a two-step process, and this is the legal advice I received from our legal department. We would have to exempt ourselves from 15 U.S.C. 260A code and uniform that was provided for in the Uniform Time Act. And then we would have to pass either a resolution or an executive order that would petition the United States Department of Transportation for us to change our time zone.
Did you have any other introductory? I want to defer to Senator Wilikowski. He has a companion bill. Any comments you want to make about your intents and how they coincide?
No. Is that it? I met with Senator McKinnon, and I support her bill. When I first ran for office, going door to door, I was surprised at the magnitude of feeling people have about this. And I surveyed it in 1 year, and 75% of my constituents support changing it. So I'm fully in support of what Senator McKinnon's doing.
Probably higher percent if you ask him in March and October. Senator Huggins, and
yeah,
McGuire.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It sounds to me like it's kind of like the tail wagging the dog. That because same with my constituents, like Senator Wilikowski said. But is the administration supportive of your bill?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, we've made a request to meet with the governor's office, and to date we haven't received a response that has allowed me to ask him that question directly.
I think that's important for us, because so we can unite the regions and understand the rationale, and you know the administration is the right place to do that. So, I apologize to the past years when we didn't get this done, because I think it was artificial, and I think people realize that. And I commend you for taking this task on again.
Thank you, Senator Huggins.
Senator McGuire.
Oh, thank you, through the chair. Yeah, and I, the same thing, Senator McKinnon, thanks for bringing it forward. I've supported it in the past, and it's just never quite made it across the entire finish line. But it's a little bit like seatbelts, I think, this one. This is one that neighbors have talked to me about for years. And whether it's their kids or whether it's workplace attendance, and and other things. And I wanted, to that end, you listed a series of impacts on the economy and health, et cetera, and I didn't hear anything about, I see NFIP in here supporting it and Chamber of Commerce. Is there any data on that? What type of workplace inefficiency do we lose on the front end and back end of that? I know there's an impact on the schools and the teachers talk about that, but I've heard anecdotally from employers as well.
Mr. Chairman, if I might have my staff.
Senator McGuire, through the chair. I have two studies that I can provide to you or through the committee. One highlighted cyber loafing. It's something that was new to my vocabulary. It's something that happens after the switch in the spring when we lose an hour. There is an increased traffic on shopping and non-work-related websites. That's one of the studies that shows that there's an increase in that. There's also an increase in workplace injuries and lost time at work, and that's a financial impact to businesses. And I can provide those to you if you'd like to.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Originally, when we carried the bill, the IT person came forward to the state of Alaska, and because we have older mechanical systems, all of those systems have to be reset manually. And certainly with technology and replacement of some of those things, that is becoming less important. So I'm not sure if we'll be able to quantify this time. If you have old equipment, you're having to manually reset all those clocks. So when I sat here and when I started my conversation with you this morning, I said, to me, it's just frustrating, and so I can live with the frustration. But some families, it's more than frustration, and there is quite a bit of lost time. There is some data about, I read an article that was saying how many thousands of hours were lost as far as gross domestic product by just changing the clocks twice a year, and all the manual ones that were still changing, even though other technology provides easier transitions for us.
Senator Coghill.
Probably to your staff, I didn't hear it properly or it needs to be explained better, and that is why we have to talk to the Department of Transportation for the what section of authority to deal with this particular issue.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, we have to notify the Department of Transportation so that they notify all of the countries and there's a central location of what the state is actually implementing. The process that we would have to go through to actually unconsolidate or change a time zone in Alaska is a resolution, and again, we would have to make our case then to change the time zone. If I could have staff follow up.
So, and that would be executive, as Senator Huggins said, that would be something that we would appeal to the executive to do.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, to change our time zone, we would have to petition, or we'd have to pass a resolution requesting that the United States Department of Transportation change our time zones.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, should we have a resolution prepared in anticipation of this?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, as soon as I meet with the governor of the state of Alaska, I'll let you know.
Okay, thank you. That was what my next question is.
It's my sketchy memory. In 1983, then Governor Sheffield made the personal request to then, I think it was Secretary of Transportation Elizabeth Dole, and during the Reagan administration, there was a much like our relationship with the federal government. We don't make many demands with success. We generally ask permission. That's a sketchy memory from when I was in college.
Mr. Chairman, that is from my research, that is correct.
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to just look at some of the data you gave us, and to say we're in a different time zone probably is an understatement. So one of your slides says number of days it takes to gain 1 hour after daylight savings time. In Barrow it's 6 days, in Miami it's 40 days. I mean, that's significant for us. And if you don't like that one, go to Nome, it's 10 days. Anchorage is 10 days. And, you know, if you say that's gee whiz, then you take the same Miami figure under a little different category, and it's 62 days. So, it's dramatically different. And I think it's, until you look at that sort of statistic, it's hard to gauge how significant the difference is. So thanks for presenting that to us.
That doesn't count the 6 months of the year I drive around adjusting an hour in my car because I don't know how to change the car.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, that is the most challenging problem that I have, to find the pin to poke it into your car to be able to change.
Well, you oversleep.
I know my recollections of going to, I think the adjustment forward and backwards so one of them is certainly a lot easier because our pastor commented that nobody ever shows up to church an hour early. They're the one. Any other questions? We'll go to the public testimony. Thank you, Bill. I see we have someone from Eagle River. We're going to try our best to coax an opinion out of Lynn Willis.
Morning.
Morning, Mr. Willis.
My name's Lynn Willis. I do live in Eagle River. I'm representing myself, and I support SB 6. I have been following this issue for many years. I am a little jaded. I am afraid that this legislation will meet the fate since 1999 of HB 4, HB 4, HB 176, SB 120, and HB 19. They all died in various committees of referral. I do not know why. I would like to know the reason for that. Well, like I said, this topic has not been the subject of numerous legislative hearings, and I still challenge the proponents of continuing to use this law to give me a compelling reason why we have to do this in Alaska. The 1983 time zone change advanced our clocks, at least in South Central and everybody west of the Juneau, an hour. We're on permanent daylight saving time, and it's worse the farther west you go. And Senator McKinnon, and I thank her for her efforts again, Senator McKinnon mentioned that. The sun is highest today in Anchorage during periods of daylight saving time at 2 p.m. In Kotzebue and Nome, it's at 3 p.m. The proponents of this law have argued that we need this for commerce. That may have been true in 1966 or 67 when we started this, when a business phone was a hardwired phone only accessible during business hours. That was before the Internet. We can do commerce 24/7. Okay? I worked for 14 years out at the airport, a large international cargo carrier. We use GMT. That has no recognition of DST. So the big carriers, the international companies use it. And I would again emphasize that time zones have to do with commerce. It has another reason. The proponents of DST will argue this is no big deal, but as Senator McKinnon shows, yes it is. When you mess with the human circadian rhythm, you can cause problems. And as she again mentioned, there have been state surveys that show most of Alaskans want to end this practice. Now, this is probably the most impactive law that Alaska has to put up with, those of us in Alaska. Unless you're a hermit somewhere up in Denali or out in the far Aleutian Hawaiian time zone, you're going to be impacted by this, all 700,000 of us, twice a year. So there should be a very compelling reason to do this. The proponents will argue that this inconvenience is a sacrifice we all must endure. Sometimes you're going to hear this until the entire lower 48 goes off of it. Well, DST is a parlor trick, and Senator Huggins just mentioned how long it takes to gain the time back you get by delaying sunset in Miami, Florida. It works in the temperate zones. It tends not to work in the poles or on the equator, where the length of day either varies significantly or hardly at all. And basically, and as pointed out again in the documentation included, if you want an extra hour of daylight in the spring, wait a few days. Now, there is also the disproportionate, because we are on permanent daylight time, and I can give a little personal anecdote here, we lose our morning light as soon as we implement this, and that got worse when they moved it up a month. Because I used to work out on the ramp, and it's dangerous anyway. It's more dangerous in the dark. And we would start to have daylight when those planes were arriving, and then all of a sudden we're back to working in the dark. And like I said, we were working with China and Japan. They don't observe daylight saving time, so it really made no difference to us. But the compelling reason for this is supposed to be, and the federal law allows this, to save energy. Now, energy cost is a big deal in Alaska. It's been your talk for months now and years, yet nowhere can I find any testimony in your forum or anyone else's where they're thanking us for having daylight saving time to save energy. It just doesn't exist. I talked to a utility manager, the control cost there. What influences it is length of day, daylight, and ambient temperature. Time of day has nothing to do with it. Because for whatever light you gain at the end of the day, you surely lose the next morning at sunrise. And besides, just a small point, with compact fluorescent lamps, light-emitting diodes, and photo sensors, outdoor security lighting is now absolutely dependent on ambient light, not on the time of the day. So again, I thank Senator McKinnon for her efforts. I do hope this finally goes through the entire process so we can resolve this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Willis? Thanks for your persistence, sir. And I'm a co-sponsor of this right after Senator McKinnon. So, and we did clear it out of finance the last time it was in, for just for the record. So next we have I believe there were some folks from the Juneau Chamber of Commerce, I'm trying to find my sheet here. We'll stand briefly in recess. You're here for questions. I think we have an inquisitive panel, so why don't you step forward? Or are you online?
He's online.
Oh, we're back in order.
He's online.
Mr. Mayor from Division of General Services, Department of Administration, are you online, sir?
Mayor, I'm just here to answer questions if you folks have any.
Questions, including Senator Fairclough, if you want to... And I'd like to ask them about any throw out any red flags now if they have fiscal concerns, adjustment concerns. I think this is the time for the administration to actually step forward if they have issues. Do you have any, you want to probe at all, Senator McKinnon?
Mr. Chairman, the only question that we have, we don't know if what's been replaced and how much it's costing the state of Alaska specifically to change its mechanicals twice a year.
Mr. Mayor, why don't you just provide us any fiscal, technical, or other issues that you give us your general commentary on this without endorsing it or imposing it.
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Tom Mayer. I'm the director of the Division of General Services, Department of Administration. We manage the Department of Administration, and we manage roughly 20 buildings. A vast majority of our buildings are all on electronic systems at this point, so it automatically adjusts. It's very simple to go on your computer and say turn the lights on at 5 o'clock in the morning instead of 4 o'clock or whatever the situation is. So from that standpoint, it's a minimal impact, and we do not see any fiscal savings in any way as far as utilities go for this particular change.
Oh, he's picking up. Any fiscal issues or challenges you see with this? We're going to see if there are any. Is this something you absorb within the department and your division? Just give us your best guess.
Again, at this point, we do not see any fiscal issue at all for us, for the Division of General Services or the Department of Administration. Just for the buildings that we manage, most of them have already had a significant amount of energy efficiency work done. That report's available, I believe it's through DOT, does a consolidated report. But at this point, we don't see any fiscal impact to us at all. And I just double-checked that this morning with our state leasing and facilities manager as well.
And it's hard to put a value on a happier, healthier, more rested workforce, I guess.
Pretty, pretty tough to do that from a facility standpoint. I'm yep. speaking specifically from a facility standpoint. I don't claim to be a personal knowledge of, you know, whether it would make me healthier or not.
Okay. And Senator McKinnon, I see Dr. Butler is here. He is our health person. He probably wasn't yearning to come up and talk, but this issue has been mentioned. I'm going to take advantage of you being here, sir, if you don't.
Mr. Chairman, before we let Tom Meyer go, could I just ask him a question?
Yes, absolutely.
So you help manage some of the DOT facilities, the public facilities, is that correct?
No, we do not. We only manage items that have been assigned to us by the legislature or the administration. So we manage, it's 12 public building fund buildings, which if you need, I can give you a list of those. And then we manage 6 non-public building fund buildings, which are traditionally non-office-based buildings or more warehouse type of buildings. So the DOT manages their own buildings. They have a very large portfolio of buildings as well.
So, Mr. Chairman, the two questions. Number one, is there anything that you would find in opposing a resolution that I was talking about earlier from the administration to oppose this exempting us from daylight savings?
From my standpoint, from the Division of General Services and the administration, no.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm only thinking that if DOT has such a big part of it, we should probably get them on record as well to find out if there's any reason why a resolution shouldn't go forward. And I think that might help us cover one of our bases.
And thanks, Senator Foghill. And I think there's probably a consensus to move this bill out, but I'd like to put some questions on the record. I think all departments of the administration should provide comment on any challenge they see, whether it's all the way from Commissioner Hanley and Department of Education to our DOT people that are operating transportation systems. And I'm sure there's a lot we're not thinking. I don't want any surprises down the line, and we probably don't have the ability to plumb all the depths of that, but I think this will probably end up in the Finance Committee, Senator Fairclough. And I'm sure you can facilitate that questioning. And I think that I don't want to jump to the end and then have one area of the state or one pop up with a last minute objection that because there wasn't an answer to it. So, and I know your diligence, you and Ms. Schein, I'm sure we'll make sure that there are no surprises. So, either when it gets to your committee or on the floor.
Okay, thank you.
Questions. Dr. Butler, his capacity of Chief Health Officer.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer in the Department of Health and Social Services. Always a joy to be here and see what I can remember from my past reading, and I will only comment in addition to what Senator McKinnon
said. And we won't ask you
said.
To take a position, but only just provide your general comments. We won't view this as a administration position.
Yes, sir.
Protect you.
One comment regarding the increased rates of heart attacks during the period after change to daylight savings time. I was just going to point out at least the study that I'm aware of looking at that was an analysis of data from Sweden. So it is data from an Arctic region of the world and not from a temperate area. I'm aware of at least one other study, and I would have to look at it again to really be very firm on it, that suggested increased rates of motor vehicle accidents during the day after the change in the spring forward change, which is not unlike traveling east. And, of course, the conventional wisdom is, in terms of jet lag, traveling east is always harder than going west. The third thing I'll just comment on, I had recently looked at seasonality of suicide, mainly to address a question that was raised about whether or not suicide is more common in the winter months. Suicide rates are unfortunately high year-round. There is month-to-month variability, and if there is a peak, there is one in the midsummer, but also one in the fall around the month of November. I can't really say if there's any causation related to change back to standard time from daylight savings time, but that's what the data appeared to be.
Questions for Dr. Butler? Thanks for I know you're waiting to potentially talk on another bill, but thanks for making yourself available on this.
My pleasure.
Senator McKinney, can you come back up? First, is there anybody else wishing to testify? I didn't believe there was. But, I'm sorry. Sorry for jumping the gun there, Senator McKinney. Welcome, sir.
Chairman Stoltz and committee members, my name is Mike Stedman. I am a small business owner located here in Juneau. I have ownership in Wings Airways, which is a tour operator. We cater to the cruise ships in the summertime and also Alaska seaplanes. And we're a small commuter airline. We fly throughout southeast, northern southeast here. And I currently oppose the bill. And the reason is in the summertime, as the daylight starts to dwindle, as we get on the other side of June 21st, we have late trips that will be impacted because of the daylight issue. With float planes, you can't land them on the water when it gets dark. And with our cruise ship business, we'll probably see a 20% reduction in our business because of it. Same with our charter and tour stuff on the Alaska Seapoint side in the summertime as well. So with that, I oppose the bill, and I see I have a big uphill battle here ahead of me.
A Hess referral for this.
Yeah. So I'll take any questions and answer questions.
Any questions for Mr. Stedman? Well, I appreciate your tenacity in speaking up on something where it appears uphill, at least this committee, and putting your concerns on the record. It's
sure. Yeah, it's a commerce issue for me, and it's, like I say, 20% hit on my business is pretty extreme, so it'll have a big impact upon us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stedman. Anybody else from the public? Oh, please.
My name is Mike Wilson. I'm representing the NFIB, and I speak in support of the bill. I operate aviation business here in Juneau, and we find it the daylight savings is just an inconvenience. It has to do with a lot of schedule changes. We work daylight to daylight in our business, and so if we work late evening, we have to figure out how we're going to schedule the pilot if we have to change. And the early morning hours are moving, so it's an inconvenience, and that's about all it is. And so I'd like to say we support the bill. We'd like to see it pass.
Let's see, can you assure you're a helicopter tour business as well?
Yes.
Just make Senator Coghill.
And thank you for testifying. I think the timeline of the bill, the sponsor, in trying to allow for the movement of the cruise ships coming in, I would see that as a positive. But you also run with tourism industry as well, don't you?
Correct. But our permits require us to be off, be done complete touring at 8 o'clock in the evening, so we're not affected by the as the days get shorter in the fall.
And that's is that an ordinance locally?
It's a federal permit, not Forest Service, right?
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
All right, thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't try to close public testimony too early. Is there anybody else here in the audience that wishes to speak? Is there anybody on the teleconference network? We'll go ahead and close public testimony and let the public know there will be other committees in which they can testify as well. Are there any amendments? I believe, Senator McKinnon, why don't you join us back up at the table? Let me go back and forget the amendments question. It's, Senator McKinnon, when I was back home this last weekend at a sporting event, I think I spent more time talking about education funding and issues than I did observing the attendance. And, Mr. Legg, who is the principal at one of the premier education institutions in the school district, that he had been assigned to study the daylight savings time and impact, and he was in the midst of that. Have you talked to the education community?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee, we're reaching out to every area of opportunity that we can. I believe my staff, and I'll turn around and check in just a moment, has reached out to all the school districts in Alaska.
In this particular case, the superintendent has assigned this principal. He goes, you're our lead guy, and learn up on it and let us know what our position should be.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chairman, we have reached out, and with all respect to those who testified today, we certainly don't want to adversely affect any business. After I heard from Mr. Stedman, I actually reached out to the cruise industry. Mr. Stedman, during a conversation with me, had mentioned that he thought it might be difficult to change the schedules for the cruise ship because, again, my intention is not to harm anyone but to help people in any way possible. But there are trade-offs sometimes to health aspects of how we operate, and I just think the health aspect is the overwhelming concern for me in advancing this piece of legislation, besides the frustration that people express on a daily basis. But, Mr. Chairman, we're happy to run the numbers for those who are pointing to numbers. When it hits the Finance Committee, we'll want to see those numbers so that we can absolutely understand how those businesses may be disadvantaged by something that the state would choose to do.
And I'm very confident you're going to continue to research the pros and cons as this, and I know your diligence. I'm not at all have any discomfort in if that's the will of the committee of moving this bill forward. So we'll see. Are there any amendments to this bill? On the fiscal notes, I just see the zero fiscal notes from the administration. You'll further study any impacts, and the administration certainly has a right to, if they learn more, to change those. But,
Mr. Chairman, my purpose is that to have a policy discussion in front of the people of Alaska. So when the administration was speaking and saying that it was specifically from the perspective of facility maintenance, it clicked that we had spoken with the Permanent Fund and the Department of Revenue. They manage the resources of Alaska, and they are affected by this in a negative way from their perspective. Their traders would need to enter the market an hour earlier, and so I just want to put that on the record that, again, this is an issue of health, and there are people that might have to get up an hour earlier if we don't do what I consider a second step is, and that is look at actually the time zones that Alaska are functioning in. I'm not opposed to that discussion. I had just been told by our legal department that that's not what I could do with daylight saving time. So.
And actually, she anticipated my comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Every policy that we bring up uncovers another need for policy, and I think the time zone really answers more to the objections of this bill than almost any other thing that I've seen so far. But if we're going to be all under one time zone, then that flexibility between the furthest east and the furthest west are just going to be in huge tension. So I think this whole daylight savings thing is going to highlight that. Was there anything that we can do as a legislature from your perspective that can help bring that issue up? Maybe it's probably a federal government issue. So is that a resolution, or how do we move forward on that?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill. We have reached out to our congressional delegation. Different states at different times are all trying to get off of daylight saving time. It's the flipping that's the problem of health. As Dr. Butler suggested, it's like jet lag, and so 5 or 10 days in, your body usually adjusts eventually, and for some people that's quicker. Some people, they don't skip a beat with jet lag, and they don't skip a beat with daylight saving time. But others are adversely affected health-wise because when they have the disruption to their circadian rhythm, it takes longer for them to reset. And so I don't know about you, but only since I've been elected have I traveled east to Washington, D.C., and so that was some 10, 15 years ago. Well, 15 years ago, I was a little bit younger, and I transitioned a little bit easier. But now, as I go forward, I'm tired. And if I'm going to invest time to travel across country, I want to be alert. And so I have to travel differently because I need to make sure I have a good night's sleep so that my body has a chance to catch up and that my brain is fully functioning and ready to go. And anyway, Senator Caulfield, there's nothing that we can do at this time except, in my opinion, recognize the health consequences and then address the business issues that Southeast Alaska has and what I see as the health and education issues in our northwestern communities, because our northwestern communities are having a struggle at being 3 hours off of their circadian rhythm. And I'm just saying, kids don't know the difference. I have a great cartoon, and we're trying to get permission to use it during this legislative cycle. It shows a baby screaming in a parent's arm, and the mom, with all respect, I don't know if it has curlers in her hair, which is somewhat maybe 1950s or 60s, or maybe 2015, but it has this baby screaming, and she's calling the federal government to say, my baby doesn't recognize daylight saving time, help me out here. And you know, if I get the permission to be able to share that with you, I will. But that's just it. So the first step is recognizing we shouldn't be flipping back and forth, so at least Alaskans can not have jet lag twice a year. Dr. Butler, if I might, March and November are higher points of suicide rates in Alaska, and we're trying to see if we can get that detailed down to the actual weeks before and after daylight saving time so we can see if there's a difference. But we are having huge issues in Alaska, and doing what we're supposed to do from a biological perspective seems maybe the right way to go.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. I'm just thinking off the top of my head, but it seems to me that switching permanently to daylight savings time solves a lot of the business community's issues. And I know you talked about it, but can you just mention again your concerns with doing that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we're in favor of that. We asked our legal department to do that originally, and they said that we couldn't. And so we reintroduced the Daylight Saving Time bill. Since that time, we did additional research with NCSL and found that several other states were actually proceeding along that line. But this is a first step to just take us off of it. And either way, you still get to the same step of advancing by going through the time zone discussion, because it's just not moving us ahead 1 hour. That would make an extra step in the process. If we just move there and stayed, we still have another step to take, and that is Northwest Alaska is 3 hours off of their sun time, and Seattle is adversely affected 1 hour off now. So we're going to have the conversation about time zones in Alaska, and it can be intertwined in this, and that's what's balled it up before. And so I would just ask for your support in moving us off of the switching and then having that conversation about Western Alaska and Southeast Alaska at a different time, understanding it's a backdrop for trying to fix things.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Go ahead and stay here until we're ready to move. I think I erred in saying there was a fiscal note. I was looking at the one for the other bill. I don't think there is a fiscal note for the administration for this. So they'll certainly have the opportunity to express any concerns or potential costs. Any other questions? Senator Wilkowski, as somebody who's introduced another measure, would you like to make a motion?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that the committee move Senate Bill number 6/H out of committee with individual recommendations.
Is there any objection or for purpose of discussion or parting comments?
And zero fiscal note.
No fiscal notes. Hearing no objections, step one of the journey, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I guess you'll need to move.
Okay.
And while we're starting the next presentation, Senator McKinnon, members will sign the report. And that is SJR 2, Constitutional Amendment, relating to issuance of school bonds for student loans.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I ask my staff, Kristen Pratt, to join me?
Please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee, SJR 2 proposes to amend Alaska State's Constitution. Mr. Chairman, this is an extremely serious issue when we have a Constitution before us. I refer you to page 30, at least of the booklet that I have, Article 9, Section 8 on state debt. No state debt shall be contracted unless authorized by law for capital improvements or unless authorized by law for housing loans for veterans and ratified by a majority of the qualified voters of the state who vote on the question. Mr. Chairman, what that means is that we can't right now use the full faith and credit for student loans. So our corporation goes out into a bond market and uses a revenue stream to provide opportunities for Alaskans to borrow. Currently, the state interest rates for student loans is 6.7% and the federal rate is 4.66. Should this be passed into law, the question would go before voters in the 2016 election. And the first time we could try to reduce student loan debt, or at least the interest rate that we charge, would be in 2017, where we would offer... It would go to the ballot in 2016, and the first time we could offer a bond would be the following year in 2018. And so the first time a student could benefit from this is 2019.
I believe there's not a prohibition of a general obligation bond. Doesn't have to be during a general election.
That's true. We could go to a special election. Mr. Chairman, this bill, should it be passed by the people of Alaska, would provide an opportunity to reduce student loan debt. We could refinance a student's loan, or we could offer a lower percentage rate. Ms. Behrens could speak to the potential of reducing student loan debt, and I would like to ask my staff if she has any additional comments that she might want to provide the committee that we've come across over the last 2 years of carrying this bill.
Ms. Pratt.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kristen Pratt. I'm staff to Senator Anna McKinnon. I don't believe I have anything to add. I think Senator McKinnon covered it. But Diane Behrens, the Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, is in the room if you guys have questions.
We will certainly query her as the administrator of this. Senator McKinnon, I'm just trying to, my memory, I'm trying to plumb it. It seems like in... we've had similar mechanisms for veterans bonds in 1982 and 2002, about 30 years, I guess 20 years apart. Are there any other, any recollection of any other bond authorization mechanism? Has it been just previously the veterans housing bonds?
It's been for capital improvements that was originally in the Constitution. Then, as you've suggested, it was amended in 1982 to include the veteran housing. So specifically, we use the full faith and credit for capital projects. This would allow an opening for something that's not capital, and being very specific. There has been conversations about trying to broaden it to give the legislature the full power and authority to use the credit rating of the state of Alaska. A AAA rating is coveted in some communities. I'm advancing this because I believe students are being adversely affected by the revenue bond stream, and we could improve that by this, and I think that the people of Alaska would support it.
And because it's a constitutional amendment, I think before we bring up Ms. Behrens, I want to have Mr. Burnett answer some questions on the revenue side. Since we had, is there a time limit on these, or was there a substantive change on the veterans' housing bonds authorizations that required us to do a new constitutional amendment 20 years later? And given we're making a constitutional change, I want to make sure we understand that fully until we get into the student bonds, just to get that on the record.
Certainly.
So I'm going to invite Mr. Burnett, Deputy Commissioner. Go ahead and stand here. I wouldn't have called you up if it wasn't a constitutional amendment. Just want to make sure we have clarity.
Yeah, for the record, Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. And I think I heard part of your question there. In 1982, I believe, is when we did the constitutional amendment to allow for veterans mortgage bonds. In 2002, we did an authorization for additional veterans mortgage bonds. I don't think it was an additional constitutional change. It was just simply authorizing more veterans mortgage bonds.
It wasn't a constitutional
change. Right.
Okay. And this mind is sometimes faulty.
And from our perspective, if I could, from our perspective, Mr. Chair, using general obligation debt for veterans mortgage loans or student loans as proposed in this constitutional amendment would have no adverse effect on the state's credit standing. It would not be included in the veterans mortgage bonds, and these would not be included in the state's calculation of state supported debt, because even though it's general obligation, it's going to be secured by the revenues from the student loan program. And the Commissioner of Revenue, and I'm the designee for that, sit on the board of the Student Loan Corporation. We're familiar with this issue. If you remember back in 2009, the Student Loan Corporation was having problems going to the market to get any kind of financing, and legislation was passed allowing student loans to be financed directly out of the general fund. And then, so this actually probably is less of an effect on the state than where we currently are. Because right now,
difficulty that was that linked to federal laws that were passed?
No, it was linked to the financial crisis that occurred and a kind of a lockup in lending for student loans directly in the marketplace.
I remember there was a time in that time period about post-secondary education prompted the legislature to pass some statutory changes on requirements
to improve the program by additional credit standards, and also we passed legislation in 2009 to allow the state to have a letter of credit to support the student loan program borrowing and finance student loans directly from the general fund.
There was an enhanced level of securitization by the right. Borrower. Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You and I believe, were together in the other body where I think it was defined, and I'm not sure it's entirely accurate. I think I've been corrected since, but we were told that the additional criteria or the change was that instead of a student that had never had a credit being scored with a positive credit rating, no credit meant no credit, and so then they were adversely affected. It's not a negative rating, it's just no rating. And so it turned out to be no rating because then students were having to go to their parents and use their credits, the parents' credit score, to be able to advance on a loan application, and required parents to co-sign on many more loans.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's some interesting provisions in this original section about the state being able to contract debt for the purpose of repelling invasion, suppressing insurrection, and defending the state in war. Probably some interesting history on that. But my question is about what are student loan rates now, and how much lower do you anticipate we could drop them with the passage of this?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm not in a position to answer that question, but Diane Behrens is here in the room. General obligation debt right now with the AAA credit rating is going to allow that money to be borrowed at a very low interest rate. It's currently, sub 3% money. So the underlying credit, but I think it would be best if Diane would answer that.
Any other questions? Well, Mr. Burnett, Senator Huggins.
Thank you. The question is very simple. There's a default rate on the mortgage, veterans mortgage is a default rate, which I've only read nationally that it was kind of alarming, but what is the default rate between veterans mortgages and, in this case, student loans in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I'm not certain of the answer to that question, so I think we can get that back to you, or Diane can answer with the student loans, but programs are structured in a way that There's additional security beyond the borrowing to allow a default rate that does not hit the lending directly, so that
And that's good, Mr. Chairman. It's important, I think, for us to get on the record. The other part, though, is that student loans have some provisions of forgiveness. I don't know whether that's a big number or a little number, but you just can't forgive mortgages. Right. And I think it would be important for the record, and Ms. Behrens maybe bring that forward a bit later, but I think the committee needs to hear that, whatever it is.
That's our intent, to bring up Ms. Behrens next, and there's a couple of people to testify from the general public. So, but we'll have some of the questions that they have. I think we'll probably be well suited to have Ms. Behrens up here. Thank you, Mr. Burnett. Man, I wish I could shake this. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Officer of the Alaska Student Loan Corporation and the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
You've heard a lot of the questions, but I know you have an agile mind. You remember all of them, and you'll proceed to answer.
Mr. Chair, not as agile as it used to be, but I'll go first through the chair to Senator Smith. The current default rate for student loans is 6.6% on the overall portfolio. If you were to compare that to commercial loans, it would appear high to you. What we do in structuring the debt to fund these loans is we essentially ensure there is an over-collateralization. So we never have a one-to-one ratio debt to student loans. We always have excess, and that allows us to offset any impacts to our ability to pay debt service on outstanding bonds. With respect to forgiveness, there have been no forgiveness provisions on the loans in some years. We did have a very limited capacity teacher education loan that had forgiveness, but that program is essentially being phased out at this point because of our inability to continue to fund that with debt.
Don't we have a medical provider's loan forgiveness, but irrespective of where that loan originated?
Yes, Mr. Chair, you're correct. There is the WAMI, which is the Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, Idaho graduate medical program. State of Alaska directly funds Alaska students' participation in that with general fund. Those students have an obligation to work in the state, and if they do work in the state, then their obligation is forgiven under that program. If they fail to, they repay the support the state has provided.
There are medical provider forgiveness, but those are provided through general fund appropriations, not out of yours. From medical personnel and all the way to ANPs, I believe. They don't come out of your portfolio.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. You're actually also referencing the SHARP program, which the legislature has funded, and that is a program whereby practitioners who come and work, and I believe in 8 different medical specialties, can have agreed to work in certain underserved areas, and in return for that, they can have up to X amount of their student loan debt paid on their behalf.
Senator Wilichowski had a question, if you wanted to rephrase it, Senator.
Two parts. What are the student loan rates now, and how do you anticipate them going to if this passes?
Through the chair, Senator Wilichowski, the current student loan interest rate is 6.7%. The Student Loan Corporation Board does approve borrower benefits each year. This year, under the benefit package, if someone is attending in Alaska, we discount that by an additional 0.5%, bringing it to 6.2%. That is revisited on an annual basis based on the corporation's capacity to pay out those benefits on behalf of the borrowers. In working with our financial advisor, they believe that we could reduce the interest on our loans by at least 1%, 1.4%, and depending on market conditions, as much as 1.3%.
I wanted to get to all the questions that were hanging before we started. Did you make your official? Did you have one, Senator? After him, sorry, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Behrens, I've been reading where the University of Alaska is looking at, let's call it homegrown teachers, producing more teachers, higher quality, and one of the target areas would be Bush communities. And previously, we had had a loan forgivement program for some of those kinds of things. And do you anticipate us being lobbied to reinstitute that program if, let's just say, the teacher production becomes robust?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, it's very possible. I know there's keen interest in that. A model like the SHARP program that the chair referenced is one that would probably be considered more effective than the teacher education loan that's being phased out right now. And that's simply because in the case of the SHARP program, you have a practitioner who's ready to be in the field, who agrees to serve in certain areas and is compensated in return for that. With the old teacher education loan, you're actually taking someone coming out of high school, going into college. They had terms in their loans that allowed them to have forgiveness benefits if they completed their degree, became a teacher, and then taught in underserved areas. So the long tail on that really resulted in only a small percentage of those loan recipients actually in the field teaching where the program ideally targeted them to.
Thank you.
Senator Coghill.
Thank you. And this would be for the sponsor first, and then maybe for Diane to follow up. But on the authorization of state debt, would that be significantly different than we do for going to the market now? Is there timelines on contracts? What would it look like, say, authorized by law? So would we have like a credit line set up, or would it be a timed contract issue, would we follow the market? So explain to me what you anticipate that might look like, and maybe Diane could fill in some of the details.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I'll just defer to Diane. It's a bonding process that they already go through. Mm-hmm. The difference underlying will be the revenue bond source, which is at a slightly higher interest rate than the full faith and credit of the state of Alaska. So it's another tool in the toolbox to try to reduce student loan debt, but the actual mechanics I'll have Ms. Behren refer to.
Certainly, through the chair, Senator Coghill, what we've discussed as a structure is having a cap authorize an amount of debt beyond which we could not issue general obligation bonds that would resolve. The actual process of going into the market is generally timed to a new lending period. Our academic year is our lending period, so typically we try to be in the market in February and March. One of the advantages of having general obligation authority is the process will be much more expedited because there won't be the kind of labor-intensive work that is involved with rating agencies examining the cash flows of the student loan portfolios and wanting to see those stressed. It really is a great application to be able to rely on the credit of the state as the standard by which the bonds are rated. So we're in the market in March, ready to start originating loans that next academic year.
So the way I understand it, then it would smooth out some of the cyclical issue by having a ready bondable system set up, basically. So, all right, that helps me. And then the other question, Mr. Chairman, putting post-secondary in the Constitution, I'm just wondering, do we have to get a better definition? Is there a flexible definition? Once we put it in the Constitution, it really takes on a different life of itself in many ways. So is there any anticipation that that becomes easier or harder to define? And maybe the sponsor has looked into that. That maybe because of the national discussion, I'm concerned that we started down the road of having a two-year education paid for by the federal government, and here we're going to put some post-secondary in there, and I'm just wondering, it looks like it's being stretched a little bit in our generation, and now that we're putting it in the Constitution, maybe there's something we need to talk about there?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, thank you for the question. It actually, the use of the funding is controlled by the legislature through the student loan statutes, and those are currently very explicitly set out as to what the loans can be made for. In Alaska, that includes vocational training, as long as the training is of a certain duration, associate's degrees and higher. So it has very specific meaning in state law currently.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, but once we put it in the Constitution, it's going to start driving the conversation rather than state law. And I just wanted to have that conversation a little bit while I'm getting comfortable with this. So.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the formula that you use to come up with your 6.7% rate that you have today?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it's the formula that has been used to date is actually fairly complicated. It looks at the cost of issuance, the cost of the debt itself, which is the rate the corporation pays, and then there is the cost of servicing. All three of those components are factored into setting the interest rate.
Mr. Chair.
Kutowski.
Yeah, I'm just, the federal interest rate is much lower. It's 4.6% for 2014-2015. We're over 2 points higher, which is significant when you're talking tens of thousands of dollars students are taking out. Do you have a breakdown of what the various components are?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, essentially Congress sets the rate, and because the federal government is not financing those loans through the federal government, through the financial markets, they can essentially choose to subsidize those loans to whatever extent they choose to, and that's a matter of federal policy. The analogy would be is if the state of Alaska funded our program with cash, the state of Alaska could set that rate at whatever rate they chose to.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Senator McKinnon, I'm sorry. I've known you so long, well before you were elected.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could try to get on the record with Ms. Behrens, the conversation about the process that the student actually goes through. So it's my understanding that we would refer most of our students to the federal program first to try to get them to access the lower cost student rates, and that they come to the state of Alaska actually secondary to their trip to the federal government to see what they can do. And the federal government, quite frankly, because of their ability to print money, is forgiving quite a few student loans now, and so we want our students to go to the federal government first. But if we could have Ms. Behrens on the record to talk about how the student enters at the wide angle and how it's narrow, it's a much more narrow choice for the student when they reach us, or even narrower when they have to go to the private sector to even get higher rates of interest depending on what they're pursuing in their educational career.
Mr. Chair, to respond to Senator McKinnon's comments, that's exactly correct, that what we do, all of our materials, the information on our website, we strongly encourage students to complete the application for federal aid to look first to the federal government. I would note that the federal government, in spite of their rate setting around the direct Stafford loan, their loans to parents are actually 0.5% higher than ours currently at 7.21%. So that is the one, if a Alaska student has exhausted their federal lending under the Stafford program, we do make them aware that our family education loan and our supplemental education loan are actually less expensive and substantially the same credit criteria is applicable to the family education loan as to the parent loan. When you factor in the discount for those who are attending or residing in Alaska, we're a full 1% below the federal rate.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bear with me for a moment. You know, some of us are flying up to Kotzebue here in a couple, 3 days to talk to the federal government that we've been in partnership with that's got their thumb on our throat and thinking they can just squeeze us for the revenue source and access to land. We're this year being asked to expand Medicaid, which is an arm of Obamacare, which appears to me that will cost us money and a whole bunch of other things over time. But I will now get to the education component of it. The President wants us to have free education at community college, I think. Is that correct, Ms. Behrens?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, there is a proposal in the President's budget proposal to have free community college. There are strings attached to that, so it's not all free, but it is a substantial proposal that would reduce costs.
You said strings attached, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. But let me just narrow that down a little bit. Let's, with those strings attached, and you take the concept to Alaska, what number of students, I mean, I'm not familiar with how many community college kinds of campuses we have that would students would qualify?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I have not done that analysis, nor have I spoken with the University of Alaska to see whether or not they have, but I can certainly follow up.
I am not supportive of that concept and those strings, but I often wonder, because I didn't, do we have community college campuses that meet the definition?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I believe we do. I believe our rural campuses, at the very least, Prince William Sound Community College or community campus would, but I suspect most of our other campuses that primarily offer associates and lower credentials would qualify. There are income contingent provisions that are in that proposal, so it does phase out if the family's income reaches certain levels. Students would not qualify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator McKinnon. I always remembered Fairclough as in tough. I don't know what rhymes with McKinnon, so that's my problem.
Mr. Chairman, I should put on the record that I have a son with a student loan debt in Alaska. I don't think that I'll be positively impacted because I hope to pay it off before 2019 with my son making those payments, but I just wanted to put on the record that one of the reasons I was interested in this is watching a son out in the workplace trying to pay off his student debts, as well as at the time I believe I had three folks in my office that were all carrying student loan debt or trying to pursue their college degrees and their credentials. So I want to put on the record that I have one son, we've paid off one set of student loans, and I have one more that I have one student loan left on. So.
Yes, Ms. Behrens, when unlike a banker, if you're dealing with somebody like the Cuddy family, they're going to want to know what their expected return is. And when you're taking a building loan, your reputation as a builder and the viability of your project. Student loans, you don't look at an evaluative different rate ability to pay if you have somebody going in engineering as opposed to somebody that might be getting a degree in drama. Mm-hmm. So it's no aspersion on drama, but there's certainly better returns on an investment.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that they do a calculator so that there's an education component of the student loan program here in Alaska that I know that my son participated in. So when he looked at a career that he might choose and then looked at how much it would cost, it actually spit out what his monthly payment would be.
Informational.
It is just informational.
Not to calculate.
Return. Absolutely.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. At some point in the future, a breakdown of the costs that are what accounts for the 6.7% rate, and in terms of what'd you say, debt? What were the three components?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, when the board sets the interest rate each year, they actually set out those numbers. So I can certainly copy you with that.
And is there, if just one more follow-up, is there any money that's Is it strictly break-even, or is there money that's returned to the general fund from that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, there have been dividends that the corporation has paid to the state. We have not paid a dividend to the state since 2009. The goal of the corporation is really to do just enough better than breaking even to keep the organization in the black.
And then do you have any sense of how our interest rates compare with other states?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, they're actually quite good, except Texas, which has funded its program through general obligation bonds, actually has loans that range from a 0% to around 5.5%. Other states, I would say we're quite comparable to what other states are doing.
Is the Texas model something that we could replicate here in Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, in the current financial climate, it would seem unlikely. Over a period of approximately 40 years, they've built up a very large fund source for that is committed to the purpose of funding the loans. And I would, I heard just on a, I participate with the State Agency Alliance on Loans, and I heard a call just recently that they are seriously looking at ending their zero interest rate loan at this time. So it is, even that is subject to the vagaries of finances.
Or oil.
Senator Conkill, and then we're going to go to the public testimony.
All right.
We have a couple folks waiting.
And that brings up the point. This is a debt-based. So you're gonna borrow money, lend it out, and it looks like it would be a contract that would be a revenue-based debt. And so for us, that debt, the way I understand it, is a bonded indebtedness. And what would that normally cost the state? Is it just operational costs? And maybe the sponsor has an idea on that.
Through the chair, Senator Cottrell, the cost of the debt itself, the commission actually services the loans for the Student Loan Corporation, so there are costs associated with servicing. Other than that, most of the cost, other than just the interest that we pay on the debt, is the cost of issuance. And the cost of issuance is, it's one-time cost typically for bond counsel, rating agency fees, and that sort of thing.
That's all I wanted to know. Thank you. That helps me get a context of it. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go on. We have three people, public testimony. I apologize, and we'll vote. If folks don't mind, we'll go a few minutes over to accommodate public testimony. First up, we have Mr. Stevens. Jumped the gun, tried to get you interested in daylight savings time.
There you go. Well, it's daylight now, so I'm awake and ready to go. Okay.
All right. My name is Lance Stevens. Not sure what else I'm supposed to say other than I'm the president of the Juneau Chamber of Commerce, and we're here in support of SJR2. We feel that any opportunity we can have to increase the participation in continuing education increases the ability to hire and recruit a qualified workforce. And then anything we can do to drive down the debt servicing costs for those coming out of those degree programs increases their opportunity to repay and lower the default rate and set them up for long-term success in their career field and in life. So we're in support of putting it to the vote to allow the state and the Department of Education the flexibility to meet the demands of our education system.
Thank you for your patience in waiting for over an hour to testify,
well,
Mr. Stevens.
There's a lot that you have to do to make the state work. A little patience is easy on my part. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I didn't see any questions. Okay. Oh, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just very quickly, Lance, and thanks for helping us out. You know, some states, particularly a large industrial base, you know, one of the common practices is if I just graduated from college and I went there and I was successful, then there's a essentially a buyout program where that company or corporation would buy out your student loan. Is that common practice in Alaska, or is it just spotty?
Well, I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that. I can only speak to what we do within my own organization. I guess I could share that. I'm not qualified to answer that question specifically. Sorry.
No, please. Go ahead.
Through the chair, Senator. Okay. The organization that I work for, we offer a reimbursement for classes that are business-oriented based on achieving a certain grade level. They have to pay up front, then we reimburse the payroll if they meet the qualifications based on years of service with the organization, starting as early as 1 year and full reimburse after 3 years up to a certain cap. So we don't offer it like you're coming to me as a college graduate, we're going to repay, but we offer our employees the opportunity to continue their education while they're working.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Like the firm did for Tom Cruise and the firm.
We can all
to worry about these mundane things or paid off your student loan.
Yeah.
That's not as commonplace.
I can't speak to that. I mean, I think it's more industry specific in the challenges that you have in recruitment to meet the demands of the marketplace. That would drive those types of decisions. I think that's typical business. You meet the demands of that are placed on your business, and you make the decisions to mediate those challenges. So if that's business has that need, they make that decision. I just can't speak to that. I'm not knowledgeable enough.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stevens.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Going to the beautiful Matanuska Valley, Mr. Coons, have you stayed with us?
Yes, thank you, Senator Schultz. And my name is Mike Coons. I'm speaking for myself, and I live here in Palmer. Senator McKinnon, she brought this forward last year, and I opposed it then, and I oppose it now. Some of the more reasons, I'm even more opposition to it, and Senator Huggins kind of touched on this a little bit. We already have a big problem with federal overreach, and President Obama, through executive order, has done pretty much a deal where the students only have to pay a certain a small percentage payment, which, of course, you know, you got the interest compounding on top of that, and then if they don't have it paid off in 20 years, then it's a total forgiveness. So that impacts the taxpayer directly, because then, where's that money that's supposed to be due back to the federal government coming from? Coming from my wallet, and I'm absolutely adamantly against that. His executive order, also according to Fox News and what I remember when this was brought up, he also forgives the defaults. So I wonder really how that's going to really help the borrower's credit rating. And if that credit was based on and got through the parents' credit scores and the parents, how's that really going to impact those parents when the student defaults? Because there's real life, and then there's the federal rainbow for what we can do anything we want. Really, in reality, it impacts directly to that borrower for the rest of their life. Then the other question, the other aspect is, what about PFD savings towards college and existing federal law for parents to save on IRA? Of course, we just saw that President Obama put a stop to that, because this rich middle-class people that were actually putting some money away for the kids' college from the day they were born to the day they got kicked out of the house to go to college, we're too rich, so he wanted to attack us on that. Fortunately, he pulled back on that. I think there needs to be more of encouragement towards Alaska parents to look at that PFD, you know, use that PFD aspect, use that that IRA aspect. I think if we can encourage that versus borrowing, I think it's a really good deal. And then a couple of other last points. I heard the other day that there was a pretty good high dropout rate of people that do go to college. You start college, you start going there, and all of a sudden they drop out. So there's a, it's kind of one of those things that's not talked about much. So I'm kind of wondering with that, how that's going to impact payback of loans if the person is going to college for a year and then they drop out and then go on to something else. The last question I've got, the big question I got too, is that the loan for, is this loan for outside Alaska colleges? It's like, you know, if a kid here in Palmer wants to get to, wants to go to Oregon State or the other OSU, Ohio State. Well, the problem there is when they go to the outside colleges, a lot of these kids don't come back to Alaska, so we don't get the economic benefits of jobs and the people coming back to Alaska doing that. So those are some of the things that I'm concerned about. Oh, and the very last thing was brought up on the 6.6% default. There's, I'm betting, if you really look at it, and I would be interested in hearing what the sponsor has in answer to this, is that if you got the veterans out there who were we don't have a high default percentage. That's, a lot of that has to do with our age and our maturity because we've kind of grown up over the years versus an 18-year-old kid, 19-year-old kid that doesn't have that age maturity and ability to really look at finances really well. So yeah, I think that's probably one of the why there's such a big increase. A 6.6% student default is substantial, and I just don't want to see us going down that road. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Mr. Coons. And I know you and I share a lot of the same personal values about personal responsibility and being personally debt-free. And there's a show called The Dave Ramsey Show that celebrates people that have found. And Dave, Mr. Coons has gotten a shout-out for his, he and his wife's commitment. And I have a lot of admiration for people that in these times that can get to that debt-free status, and there certainly is a lot of liberation in that, and pride and dignity, and not to cast aspersions on anybody, but I did have just, and you can give us, we'll look for acknowledgement, when we've dealt with student loan issues in the past, Ms. Behrens, there was kind of an unusual phenomenon in the past that you testified to, that Alaskans who didn't return to the state actually had a higher repayment rate than students that remained in Alaska. And I see an affirmative nod on there for the record to show. And it was kind of, it was a disappointing thing to hear, but it is reality. It's, and what a challenge for us to try to correct that as well. It's that the folks that don't stay in Alaska are better at meeting their responsibilities than those that do. And that's, we need to strive to correct that. Very last testifier is David Nees. The last one listed, we'll make sure we have everybody.
Thank you. David Mees, testifying for myself. I live in Anchorage. I have two children that are currently paying back student debt under the FAFSA program and the Stanford loans. My concern is that when we set up the Constitution, the only thing we bonded for were capital projects. And the reason you have that is you have a real property. You have something you can reclaim if the debt defaults. With something as portable as a college degree, you don't have that. So when you have something that is riskier, you pay a little higher interest rate. And it's a little camel under the nose here. This is I really like the idea of a lower interest rate, but I'm a little worried that, okay, what's the next program we're going to slide in there where we're going to be loaning money at a reduced rate in order to encourage work place stuff, anything like that. So, I mean, the facts I did not hear from the presenters were, what's the current default rate? We know that DEED, post-secondary is funded in the DEED, and this current system pays for 90% or 100% of the post-secondary commission's budget. So if we lower the loan rate, does that mean that we're going to have to pay for the post-secondary commission out of the deed budget separately. Because right now it generates enough income that it breaks it even, or they give a little bit back to the general fund. But if you make it lower and it's bonded, that means the entire cost of post-secondary comes back to you in the general fund or undesignated general fund. So you have to be very careful when you talk about bonding something that is portable. The reason that it costs more for this loan is because you don't have any real property to claim. You have something somebody can walk away, go to another state, and pay you back. That's why the payback rate is higher when they go out of state. They've got a job. They're paying. They're up here, and they have a degree, and they're not working. Your default rate will probably be higher. So I didn't hear anything about the default rate, and I didn't hear anything about how deed is going to pay for post-secondary if they put the income generator outside of what we're doing right now. That would just be my questions that probably should be answered.
We're going to invite, we're not going to have time to get into a whole interactive debate, but Ms. Behrens, you just want to put some general comments on the record here, just as we, I don't want to leave those probing questions just as rhetoricals. Let's respond to those.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Diane Behrens, Executive Officer of the Alaska Student Loan Corporation. As I mentioned earlier, the current default rate is 6.6 on the outstanding portfolio. We actually expect that default rate to continue to decline. There are older loans that had the credit ready standard applied to them for eligibility. We actually have had a higher credit requirement for the last several years, and so expect to see improvement in that default rate. The structure that we're proposing should really affect no change in the way the commission's activities are funded. We don't expect to shift any of our supported costs to the general fund, but would continue to pay that out of Student Loan Corporation receipts.
And I suspect in the Finance Committee there'll be you'll have more probing on this issue. We're dealing with just the basic concept as we're deciding whether to forward this.
Right.
I see an affirmative nod from Senator McKinnon that she's going to have to deal with the tough financial questions and ensure the fund. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Behrens, let's just say that I have the student loan, all right, and I'm one of the 6.6 that defaulted. Do you exercise or do you have the discretion to be able to go to my employer and essentially get a piece of my paycheck back to pay for that 6.6%?
Yes.
Do you exercise that?
We do, actively, through the chair, Senator Huggins. The legislature has given the commission the authority by statute to issue administrative wage garnishments, and we do that on a regular basis. The other tool that we use to the extent that we're permitted is we garnish permanent fund dividends. And that is something that the commission, I believe, is third in line after child support and court-ordered restitution.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to make sure, Mr. Nees, I hope you had partial answers to your questions at least.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. And before we go, is there anybody else from the public? We'll get back. Why don't you stay up there? There are some questions. Anybody else from the public? Either here in Juneau, don't see any online. Is there anybody else online from the public or state agencies? Hearing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. And, Senator Wilkinson.
Yeah, quickly, of the 6.6% default rate, after you garnish wages and permanent fund checks, do you have a sense of what percent is actually not recovered?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, I can provide write-off information. We do discharge debt in terms because of default, because of a death, or a permanent total 100% disability. So I can provide you with write-off figures.
Thank you.
And you will handle all these yourself in the Department of Law, or do you outsource any of it?
Mr. Chair, we do all of our internal state of Alaska collections. If we are unable to collect using those internal tools, we do have an external third-party collection agency that pursues debt both in and outside of Alaska.
What do you get on a percentage on that under ideal circumstances?
Ideal. Once they're sort of badly aged, if you recover about 15% of that debt, you're doing a pretty good job.
Okay. Any other questions? Any other questions for the sponsor before we go into general discussion? Are there any other issues lingering that the committee would like to examine before moving this on? Are there anything we would have a need to hold this for any further? So that sounds good, Senator McKinnon. Are there any amendments? And I see the one fiscal note, and that's from the anything that's printed in the election pamphlet. And certainly, we'll have a continued discussion on the activities of the Department of Education and their agency within and finance. Senator Coghill.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I know there are further questions to go on this, but at this point, I would move that we move SJR 2 from committee with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal note.
Are there any objections? This is the best batting average you're going to have this week anyway, two for two. And with that, apologize for anybody that we had marijuana listed as a time available basis, but again, we'll continue our more focused discussion. I want to thank Senator Willikowski. He was brought up the suggestion of bringing in Ms. Leffler from the U.S. Attorney's Office to discuss the federal issues, and we're working on facilitating that to have the federal discussion on their issues regarding. I appreciate that, and I welcome any other suggestions from the committee how we can continue our discussion on this absent a bill. It's I guess we're continuing as a real friendly deposition of gathering information, so which is an important role for this committee because there's more questions than answers on a lot of this, so we'll continue that, and I welcome any input and suggestions how to facilitate that discussion in the time we have available, given the 12, 15 commissioners we have to review, and board members, and the various other legislation that are individual priorities of members. But mindful of that, we'll continue our marijuana. We'll try to give everybody a heads up on when we'll continue that again in earnest, but we do have legislation up this week. So with that, no other business before us. There was no objection. The bill moved out of committee with the individual recommendations. We'll adjourn, ask members to stay until we sign the report.